This is Gretchen Hegeman, The Hand as Symbol, December 9th, 1994.
It's always interesting to prepare for these kinds of events because at least I go through imagining what you'll look like and if you'll have stern faces or if you'll be kind of smiling. And I go through stages where my hands get icy cold, and I'm sure that I will forget everything that I have prepared. And so now I'm up here. And I'm very excited about doing this. So as Lucretia said, we've known each other for a good 11 years, actually. And that time that we met in Pajaro Dunes was my first exposure to sand play therapy. I'd sort of driven down on a lark to Pajaro Dunes and was totally blown away. Some of you have heard this story before, but I had no idea what I was getting into. And I found in the work that Frau Kalf presented just everything that I was interested in. I was interested in Jungian psychology. I was very interested in symbols and art. And I had a very strong feeling about the importance of the spiritual in one's therapy work. And here it was all put together into one particular modality. And I left Pajaro Dunes and bought my first sand play figures. So that started this journey that still continues. Tonight's presentation is on the hand. And I appreciate Lucretia pointing out that I do like to use my hands. I do. And as I've done this research, I found that the hand is like one of the earliest symbols. And we'll see the hand appearing in caves from 6 centuries before Christ, just very, very ancient. The hand is also important in sand play because the hand is the mediator between our unconscious and our conscious self. And when we work in sand, we take our hands and we put them in the sand. And they also choose figures from the sand play shelves. Sometimes our hands really surprise us, both if we're doing sand play and and also just in our regular life. I don't know if any of you have ever tried writing from your non-dominant hand in your journaling, you know, and you're just amazed at what comes out. And that's the unconscious speaking. So to begin, I'd like to give some appreciations. First, to the archive for the research on archetypal symbols. Are any of you familiar with this organization? It's a wonderful library of images, and it's housed in the Jung Institute in San Francisco, and there is another library, RS File, in New York City. And anyone can go there and look up a symbol. They have images that start from the Paleolithic time and go all the way through the contemporary. And they are images of like the hand or other symbols that have to do with ritual or with mythology. And it's an incredible place if you like to research. I fail to say that another thing that sand play has allowed me that I love to do is do research. And it sort of warms up the scholar in me. I'd also like to give thanks to the librarian at the RS File in San Francisco, Michael Flanagan, who gave me a slide from his personal collection when we couldn't find one. And I'll point it out to you later. It was a real important slide. I also would like to thank Dana Mattson, who's in the second row, and her sweetheart, John Serbert, who brought the element of the child into this workshop. Dana and John and I spent a wonderful Sunday morning making all of these hands that you see around here. And it was just what I needed. I really felt like we needed to have hands welcoming you and bringing you into the building. And I hope that you saw some of the ones that are outside. So thank you, Dana. I'd also like to thank Dan Norris from Ancient Images. They are a card company that makes beautiful cards of natural settings all through the United States. And Dan had a card that had handprints on it from, you're right, from the southeastern part of Utah. And you'll be seeing these slides. I also want to thank the King County Library for finding out-of-print books for me and tracking one book down to the Upper Iowa University Library. To David Capitolo, whose sculptures you will see at the end of this first part of the presentation. He made a very profound sculpture called The Blessing. And to the Jung Society for allowing me to do this and allowing me then the opportunity to pull this material together. And lastly, I'd like to give a great deal of appreciation to my husband, Dennis, for his support and for all the work he's doing tonight in helping keep the show on the road. So thank you, Dennis. So I'd like to start, Dennis, we could have the next slide. Some time ago, the people at Birgitta House asked me to come and talk. And they said they wanted me to just come and talk to their staff and do, you know, a little presentation for five or six people. And they said, we'd like you to just do whatever you want, whatever is interesting you right now. And this is, I mean, this is a wonderful invitation, or it was for me. And I started thinking about it, and what I had begun to notice at that time was that sometimes children and grown-ups would leave a handprint in the sand. And my intuition was that this was important when somebody took their hand and just put it into the sand and left a mark. Like it was maybe something like saying, I am, I exist. So I started tracking that and pulling my thoughts together about that. And I was walking Wiley, who most of you have met. And at the schoolyard, there were these handprints on the window. Dennis, can I have the next slide? And this was another window. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I'm thinking about hands, and here's some hands. And then, Den, the next slide. A few days later, as I walked in the schoolyard, I found this large cargo container decorated with handprints. And the school I live close to is called Phantom Lake, which is here. It's this Phantom Lake. Note these hands with these little empty spaces in the center, because they'll come up when we look at the cave paintings. It's wonderful to see all these kids' hands. So that got me thinking, okay, here's all these hands that I see every day now as I walk the dog. Then the next slide. And there's a close-up of, see how the hands look and how, like, even here, sometimes you miss a thumb, I guess because of the ridge. But anyway, these were probably third, fourth graders. Next one. Okay, and the next one. Right at the same time, a friend sent me this piece of jewelry, which is called a hamsa from Israel, and it's a good luck symbol. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Then the next one. And then my landlord put up these sculptures, these metal sculptures of Haida and Tlingit hand motifs. And they look to me exactly like the hamsa. You know, here they have this eye shape in the center. And in the hamsa, that turquoise jewel was That's to sort of essentially ward off the evil eye. You know, you have the eye that keeps the bad stuff away. Next one, hon. Okay, here's another, a couple more of these hands. And the next. And then this one. Okay. And then my landlord, whose name is Lowell Halverson, hung this blanket that he had made up in his the reception area of his law offices. At this point, I said to Lowell, what does the hand mean? You know, he is part Tlingit Indian. And he said, oh, it just means friendship. And he had made this blanket for a national meeting of lawyers, and this was to indicate friendship among all the lawyers. So all of these things coming together, these synchronistic events, you know, things coming together in time and space, but that also had an emotional charge for me, made me decide that I would definitely talk about the hand at Birgitta House. So that was the beginning, and I just wanted to share that with you because it was, it felt very Jungian to me to have these experiences. So, okay, the next slide then. What I'd like to do is show about 7 or 8 slides that gives some sense of the variety of meanings of the hand, and then show a series of maybe 25 slides that show the hand through history and some of the important evolutions of the hand. And then we'll take a break. After the break, I will talk a bit about sand play and show you the handprints that appeared in my sand tray experiences. And then at the end, the back of the room is set up so that everyone can make handprints if they want to, or something else. There's paint supplies and spray bottles, all kinds of things. So if you feel like you'd like to do that, I'd love to have you do that as well as just hear me talk. Okay. I need to say, too, this is I'm doing this in a very sand play way, because when we share cases in sand play, it's always with the slide projector going, you know, and images on the screen of one sort or another. So this is kind of what I'm used to. All right. This is Pontius Pilate, and he's sort of looking up towards the sun, which is up here, and he is washing his hands. And this is where the expression, I wash my hands of the matter, comes from. The story that goes with this was that it was normal during this time for someone who was passing judgment to raise their hands to the sun and to indicate that they were innocent of blood. And Pontius Pilate decided to do it one better. And so he both raised his hands to the sun and he washed his hands and then showed them again to the sun. So this is the evolution of that expression, I wash my hands of this matter. And this is a fresco from 1050. It's from the Church of San Angelo in Italy. Next slide, please. This is Jung's palm from his 75th year. There's 75. Jung was very interested in serology and wrote the introduction to a book by Julius Speer called The Hands of Children. And this book was published in 1944. And this is the book that I found that came to me through the Upper Iowa University Library. and Jung wrote in this introduction, and I think this is very important, the totality conception of modern biology, which is based on the evidence of a host of observations and research, does not exclude the possibility that hands, whose shape and functions are so intimately connected with the psyche, might provide revealing and therefore interpretable expressions of physically peculiarity, that is, of human character. modern science increasingly relinquishes the medieval conception of the separateness of body and mind. And just as the body, in the view of science, is neither something mechanical nor chemical, so the mind seems to be but another aspect of the living body. Conclusions relating to one or the other would therefore seem to be within the range of scientific operations. Speier believed that the right hand showed the history, all of the ancestral history of the person, and that the left hand showed the potential and the future. Now, this serology is different from palm reading, in that palm reading essentially says that if this line means this, whereas in serology, it's a holistic way of looking at the hands, and it includes the nails and the fingers and the whole of the hand. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, says too, if you look at your hand, you see all the past generations and the future. Okay, Den. Now, these are the bones of the hand, and or of the fingers, actually, not of the hand. And I just wanted to acknowledge two things with this image. One, that the way we are different from apes is that we have a thumb that works. We can use it, whereas we rely on our thumbs. And I also wanted to acknowledge that there are many systems that diagnose from the hands and the fingers, like reflexology, acupuncture, shiatsu, and also serology, which we've just talked about. Next slide. This is from Albrecht Dürer. This is Eve holding the apple. And this is from 1507. And this is a study print of a painting that he did, I guess, of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Am I talking too fast? No? Okay. I wanted to include this because the word for evil and the word for apple are the same in Latin. And hence there was this story that then developed that the tree of knowledge was an apple tree. And anyway, and here's Eve, who got us all into so much trouble. Okay. Next one, please. Everybody knows this, right? The stop sign. Interestingly, this stop sign is similar to one of the mudras, the hand seals in Buddhist iconography. And we'll see some of those later on. But I wanted to include this because it is from our daily life. Dennis, my husband, pointed out also that below this hand, we have a handle. So and I forgot in the blanket handprint image that we saw from my office building, there's a paddle below the blanket so that there is also something for hands to do. Okay. Next one, please. Okay, this is, we'll see a second slide of this. This is the temptation of Christ. He's being tempted by this devil. And this is Christ's right hand, like the stop sign, warding off, and the devil's left hand. And this is probably where some of the things, the history of right and left hand having good and bad connotations comes from. Next slide. And here's Christ himself with his right hand with the protection warding off. And this is probably supposed to be a book that he's holding in his hand. Edinger talks today or speaks about the temptation of Christ as corresponding to events in our individual psyches when we encounter the self. all degrees of inflation up to overt psychosis may occur. Christ's answer to the devil provides a valuable hint in meeting these dangers. We must seek the relevant transpersonal images that will provide us protection. Next hand. This is a contemporary icon by a painter whose name is Robert Lentz. And it is called the Madre de los Parecidos, the mother of the disappeared ones. We've all heard about the black hand and its relationship to the mafia. The black hand came into existence in New York City in the 1910s. At that time, there was this huge influx of Italian immigrants into New York, and New York had more Italians than Rome did. And amongst this huge population were more than 5,000 ex-convicts from Italy. And the New York police was at a loss for what to do, how to manage these people. And these criminals did many, many kidnappings and robberies, but mainly kidnappings. And when they kidnapped someone, they left this black handprint. This white handprint that we see here comes from the death squads in El Salvador. When the death squads would come and kidnap someone, take someone away, they would leave a white handprint. So this icon honors the mothers who, I think most of you have heard about, the mothers who did silent vigil for many years, just holding pictures of the children and loved ones who had been taken away from them. And these mothers, who are the Madres de los Desaparecidos, wore white kerchiefs and usually black dresses, and they just were silent, holding the pictures of their children. And they would wear either a red rose or a white rose to indicate if they thought their person was alive or dead. The white rose was for someone who they hoped was alive, and the red rose for someone who they were sure was dead. So I just wanted to include this because I think it's a very powerful image. Okay, Dan? Now, these are the handprints of children in a cave in an area called Gargas in the Haute Pyrenees Mountains. And they are from the Paleolithic era. I'd like to share these words that don't come from that cave, but come from the Pueblo Indians, that I think reflect the mystery of these hands. After coming to the upper world, everything was so new, they left hand and footprints everywhere they touched, because everything was so soft. They faced east. When the sun came upon them, their eyes were open. The description of these hands is that they are massed like a cloud that rises from the floor of the cave and goes all the way up to the ceiling. There's some suggestion that the fingers are mutilated, but it's really uncertain if the fact that certain fingers don't seem to be there is because of some kind of sacrifice, mutilation, or because of illness or disease like leprosy, perhaps, or frostbite because the living conditions of these people were so hard, or if it's just because they were children and they were being playful, you know, and not having their fingers, you know, hiding a finger or doing something like that. So, don't know. Next slide. These are 60 children's handprints, and they come from Anatolia, from Ketal Yurik. You're going to have to forgive my pronunciation sometimes. This is from the Neolithic period of 6,000 BC. And see, like, isn't this like that little cargo container? Look at these little open circles in the hands. Next slide. And this is from North America, from Whitefish Bay in Ontario, Lake of the Woods. And this is a bison. This is more contemporary, bison and handprints. Next. And these were identified again from Gargas and show some of these mutilations or that are speculated upon. If the cave people mutilated their fingers, they were part of a tradition of mutilation that has occurred among Aboriginal people all around the world. This occurs among the Bushmen, the Hottentot, the Pygmies, and also amongst our northwest coastal Indians, the Tlingit and the Tsimshian, and the Haida. Next, please. And these are the slides from southeastern Utah. These are probably, I don't know the date, but I would expect probably after the 16th century, you know, maybe relatively contemporary. And you can see these are, put your hand against the wall and then blow. And there are spray bottles in the back so you can simulate the experience if you'd like to later. Next one. There's some more up here. And the next. It's like one of the things that Dan Norris, who took these pictures, told me was that he found a kiva recently in the same area where all the handprints around the kiva were children. And it was, there were no grown-up hands at all. Next one. And this shows both this kind of outlining technique, and these were paint on the hand. Next. Yeah. This is the one that's on the card. You'll probably see it now when you go card shopping. Okay. Next. This comes from Phoenicia, from the 13th or 14th century BC. So that this is an image that's earlier than some of the cave images that we've seen already. This slide shows, this is a rock carving, and these are the hands of the goddess Tanit. And she's giving blessing to the people and also to the crescent moon. And that is the symbol of the moon god, Haman. Haman was likened to Cronus because he ate his children. And Tanit also demanded sacrifice. And among the Phoenicians, children were sacrificed to the god and the goddess. At the same time, it was through the sacrifice that the fertility of the land was assured. And so we have a very impersonal god or goddess that gives and takes away. It's very objective, very ruthless. Next image. And this is from the 18th dynasty of the New Kingdom of Egypt. And this is the pharaoh Akhenaten and his queen Nefertiti and their daughter. And this is the Aten, the sun god. And it was Akhenaten who did away with all of the anthropomorphic gods and said that the only god that the Egyptians would worship would be the sun, the Aten. And in this image, you can see that the rays of the sun come down to be hands. And in front of the nostrils of both the king and the queen, or the pharaoh and pharaohess, is the Ankh. And this meant that only they received the blessing of the Ankh. A parallel occurs in European royalty. that the kings, and particular kings, had the what was called the royal touch. And what this meant was that the king was the healer. And so all the sick people would come to the court to receive the blessing of the king. And the assumption was then that the king would heal them. And I just made the parallel that it reminds me of them having the blessing of the Ankh, which they can bestow on others. Next slide, please. This is more contemporary. This is an Aztec goddess, Coatlicue, and she's from the 15th century. This is her head, which is two rattlesnakes looking at each other. And around her neck is a necklace of severed hands and hearts. And this is a belt buckle, which is another head of a serpent. And then her feet are jaguar claws. She, as Neumann would say, is a real example of the terrible mother. She, like Tanit, really demands what's hers, and she demands the sacrifice. Hence the hands and the hearts around her neck. But at the same time, when she is full, she then brings the blessings back to the land. The Aztecs, their deities were different than the Mayans in that their cosmos was very unstable, and that things could really fall apart if the gods were not given their due, and hence the ongoing sacrifice. Okay, next slide, please. This is also Aztec, and it is a drum made out of basalt, and this is of a god whose name is Tepanatzli. And this is again from the 12th through 15th century. And you can see how his face, the eyes are formed by hands that have an eye or a mouth shape in them. And his ears are formed by with hearts that are attached to these hooks. The drum represents eye-hand coordination. And as many of you probably know, that the way a child's mind develops is through the use of the hand, through crawling and through using the hands. And the drum is another reflection of that. I want to say, too, that music was important to the Aztecs, and they had a school called the House of Song. And drumming, some people think, and I know there are a couple drummers in this room who might want to comment on this later, but that like the drum is like the eye. I mean, the hand is like the eye, that it has so much sensation. And I think this is also behind some of the therapies like Reiki that use the hand or the laying on of hands so that the hands are like eyes. Okay, next slide. This is from Moundsville, Alabama, from, again, the 12th through 15th century. And this is a palette that has a hand in the center with an eye and these two incredible snakes that are knotted. They have kind of these crests on their heads. This motif is an indication of the shaman's hand, the healer. And usually when there is an eye, and sometimes there would also be a crystal placed in the eye, when there is this, it means that the person has the ability to see into the future or to journey into the other realms. The fact that there are these snakes around the outside shows that the hand of the shaman can control the forces, the snake-like forces, the forces of renewal and regeneration. And that the snakes also represent the unconscious, so that the hand of the shaman is able to transmute the energies of the unconscious. Next slide. Oh, okay. This is a Tlingit, excuse me, no, it's a Haida bentwood box that has the same motif of the hand with the eye, like the ones that Lowell did at my office building. And amongst the coastal Indians, too, the hand with the crystal in it is an indication of the healer. Next slide. And here we have an Aboriginal person holding their fingers in such a way to make the hand and the eye. Den, next. Okay. The next series of four slides are of Buddhas with their hands in postures that are called mudras. And the first three all are various aspects of the same mudra, which is called the mudra of appeasement. This hand, like our stop sign, is protecting. And the story goes that the devil wanted to tempt the Buddha, and so he got an elephant very drunk and encouraged the elephant to go and charge the Buddha. And the Buddha put up his hand like this and stopped the elephant dead in his tracks. And so that this hand on Buddha's statues is the hand of protection. This hand is the hand of offering and of inviting people to come and gather around. So one is protected in the gathering. Next slide. This is a Chinese example of the same hand postures. And this is from the 3rd century. Next. And this is an Indian Buddha from the 6th century with another. When I was trying to understand about mudras, it was difficult because there can be many variations on one particular theme. So as far as I could figure out, these were all the same mudra, although they look differently. But this one's very clear with the protection and the other hand offering. Next one. This is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And you can tell that because he has more than two hands. He's got four at least. And the promise of this particular bodhisattva is that he will not enter nirvana until all sentient beings have gotten there before him. So this is, needless to say, a Buddha for people of who really see their work in the line of compassion. Den? This is not a Buddha. This is from the Mayan culture, 6th, 7th century, and it is a maize god. And isn't this remarkable how much he looks like the Buddha? Besides protecting the young shoots of maize, he also is the protector of young married couples. And when I was looking to see if there was a mudra that was like this, I found one called Amida, or Amida, and it means welcome to paradise. I think that's perfect for young married couples. Okay. Next, please. Now, this is a slide that Michael Flanagan gave me, and this is a front and back image of the hands of Sabazius. And Sabazius was a Roman god of fertility and agriculture. And you can see here, it's not a very good slide, unfortunately, but there's a snake. And the snake played a big part in his mysteries. And two fingers are down here, and this is a little person. By David Capitolo, and it is a image of a father and a son. And I think rather than that just the father is bestowing a blessing on the son is giving one back too. In Buddhism, and perhaps also in Catholicism, but I don't know that for a fact, a blessing is a way for a learned being to impart their wisdom to someone. When you ask for a blessing from a Buddhist teacher, it is like his entity is coming then through you. And so here we have it going both ways, with the father giving blessing to the child, and the child, I think, giving back to the father. Next. You can see it. Next. Next. This was the first time that David had ever made a sculpture. It took a year. It was part of a special project. The next. Real. Isn't this like from the Sistine Chapel? Next. Maybe, is there one more, or is that it? Okay. All right. This ends the first part of tonight's talk and slideshow. I guess we should have maybe Lucretia, John, Paul, 10-minute break? Or should I entertain some questions? Are there questions, or should we just take a break? Break. Okay. Okay. I wasn't sure if this was a Sanplay crowd in totality or not. So I'll say a little bit about what the Sanplay is like. Where about the lights?
Oh.
Okay. Sandplay therapy originated in a Jungian way with the work of a Swiss woman whose name is Dora Kalf, and perhaps her book is outside tonight. She became acquainted with the work of an English child psychiatrist whose name was Margaret Lowenfeld. And Lowenfeld had a clinic for children in London. And she had developed a technique where she had boxes with sand in them. And she had cupboards with doors on them. And these were filled with all kinds of things, people and animals and pieces of string. And children would come in and they would make a story. Lowenfeld's idea was that she was looking to find a diagnostic tool that wasn't contaminated by the relationship with the therapist. And she felt that children working in a box of sand might be a way to avoid some of the transference that comes up with the therapist and then would affect the picture you got. So this slide is of Dorokhov's house in Zollikon, Switzerland. And I always love to start with this slide because for me, it was very important to realize that this house was built 10 years before the Americas were discovered by Columbus. The date on this house is 1483. And so to think of entering the world of the archetype and you enter a house that is as old as, sort of their first explorers, white explorers to this country. Mrs. Kauf, when she bought this house, said she wanted a house that had a grape arbor, and here this is the grape arbor, and a Madonna. The next slide. And this is the Madonna in the garden of Mrs. Kauf's house. And you have to take a look at the hands. Next slide. And this is Mrs. Kauf, and this is from the journey that Lucretia and I took in 1984. This was at the end of our seminar, and we gave her a huge bouquet of roses. This room where the seminar was taught is the living room of the house, and when the house was bought by Mrs. Kauf, one of Jung's sons, who was an architect, restored the house for her. And he said that this room was far older than the rest of the house, and that it probably dated from somewhere, I think, between the 8th or 10th century. And that it was a way house for people going on the Crusades, for pilgrims. And you can see some of that with the thickness of the walls. This is the window here, and this is how thick the walls were in that part of the house. Next slide. This is the door to the part of the house where the sand play room is. And I just love this door with this wonderful mandala. And wish that I had a door like that, needless to say. Next slide. These are sand trays. Usually in the sand tray therapy, a person is offered the choice of dry sand, which is this, and wet sand, which is this. These are my sandboxes, and the sand I use is from the beaches around here, and so it's rather dark, kind of volcanic. But it feels more natural to me to have sand that color, and because it is from here, rather than very white sand, which is really like from Hawaii, and I'm not from Hawaii. So there are exact measurements to these sand trays. They're 28.5 inches long, wide, 19.5 long, and 3 inches deep. Next slide. This is just the wet sand. Next. The bottoms of the trays are painted blue so that when a person works with the sand and they want to make lakes or rivers or something of that sort, they can do so. Next slide. These next slides are my office so that you can see what a sand play setup looks like. This is the front room. Looking in, and here's a table for working with kids doing drawings or also with adults. And the beginning of the collection of miniatures. The idea is that the miniatures that you use in the sand to make the story, that what you have available to you is reflective of the universe so that you could make whatever. I mean, it doesn't have to be enormously large collection of things, but there needs to be a good variety of things from the earth, from the archetypal realm of people, of animals, so that you can make a story. And the idea of how sand play works is that if a person does this process over a period of time, that the healing energies that are potential in each of us get activated, and we can touch the true self. And when that happens, it is usually a very numinous time, and the trays of this experience are very beautiful, or they have a very holy quality to them. And when this experience happens, new energies from the psyche are really stimulated and opened up, and a person is much more able to work on complexes and very difficult problems that before seemed insurmountable. I am totally in awe of this process because I have seen it work in such profound ways, ways that I would never have expected. And so I am just so deeply moved by what is potential in each of us, and that even though each of our psyches is different, there are also certain markers that show the way and that one is on the way. And I think what I'm trying to figure out about the handprints is sort of part of that process. So, Dennis? Here's, these are just photographs of my shelves with all the things from the sea and from nature and different animals. And these are Smurfs up here. I have lots of Smurfs and houses. And here, soldiers and Indians and working people. And these are fish and bird, and then birds over here. Next. Still can't see this. These are real tiny figures that I keep in shadow boxes so that they don't get overwhelmed. And some kachinas up there. Next. And here, more of the animals. And here, some of the archetypal figures, Shiva and Christ. Earth goddesses. The dollhouse was built for me by my father when I was 6 years old. And I'm really pleased that I have it available for people. Next. And okay, here's the Smurfs again. I really like those guys. And they're important, you know, they're sort of our modern dwarfs. And so it's wonderful, especially children use them a lot. And we'll see one person who uses the Smurfs. Okay, next. Okay. I've been trying to figure out, like, what is really going on when a child or an adult puts the handprint down. And I'm going to start with two series that include finger paintings, where the hand emerges. For a while I started, I thought, this is just an expression of I am. I'm really here. And then I began thinking about the transcendent function and what Jung wrote about with the hand being able to solve puzzles that the mind just couldn't grapple with. And started thinking maybe somehow these handprints were an aspect of the transcendent function in the sand, although the whole sandplay process really is that because it's the unconscious being put into consciousness. So I'm still speculating, you know, and I don't know if what's happening with people who work with me happens with other people, or if it's peculiar to the energy between my psyche and theirs. And so for those of you that do sand play, I would love to know what happens if you start observing hands so that we can figure it out together. Because it's a riddle. The other day I was talking with Kay Bradway, sort of one of the matriarchs of sand play. She's 83. Many of you probably know of her writing and works. She said that when she used to meet with Mrs. Kalf, that when the hand appeared in the sand, it meant that a new ego was formed. But in her experience, the hand appeared after there had been some kind of centering or constellation of the self. And in my work, it happens before.
See, so that's what I mean. I don't know exactly what it means, but it's very intriguing to me. So this was a young girl of four who was suffering from moving from another city and from a terrible older brother who was torturing her. And her symptoms included that she held her bowels. And one day I invited her to work with the finger paints, and this series of finger paintings occurred. Dennis? More? Next? I see the hands starting to come out. Next? And then this. And here we have these little shapes again. So then the next time she came in to see me, she did the following. Oh, gosh, this is terrible. She was 4 years old, remember, so this is quite sophisticated. This is a castle that she didn't make the castle. That was pre-built. she has the castle, and she made these separations, and this was all watery, and it was sort of like this whole watery new world was emerging for her. Okay, next slide. Now here's the Smurfs. This is a girl of eight. And when the Smurfs appeared, I thought, uh-oh, something's going to happen next. You know, she's mobilizing these interior instincts. So she was very proper, young lady. Dennis, next one. And she decided she wanted to finger paint. So we need to see how proper we were here with the tarp and all of that. And just go through these, please. Next. And look at these wonderful rainbow hands that she made. And then the next one. And this is what blew my mind. She made a watery world. Look at this. Here she's got this big kind of watery lake kind of thing going on, and birds, and I don't think there are any fish. But this was her experience, the water. Okay. Next one, please. This was a boy who was really suffering from divorce, and he had made countless war scenes where nobody stood up. Everybody was annihilated. So here, I was quite impressed. He had a barricade to protect these guys, and over here, three handprints. Next slide. Here's the three hands again. Next one. The next time he came in, he took the monsters. They had a fight, and the monsters were all, or a good half of them, are down, destroyed. That was a big achievement. This was a child who had terrible night terrors and just couldn't sleep the night at all, and his mom was just having a very hard time with that. Okay, next one. He was seven. And then he made another war scene. And here again, there are defenses and camouflage. There's a bridge. And they're soldiers of this era rather than knights. Okay, next. I'm seeing that it's 10 after 9, so I'm kind of... All right, now this is another boy of the same age of seven. And he's got the monsters fighting soldiers. And there's some Indians, anonymous kind of Indians out here, and some other soldiers. And during the war, the following happens. Dan? The monsters get defeated. They're down here in the other sandbox. And look what's here, a handprint. So I just stumbled across this one recently, and it was like, wow. And then the next scene, please. And then he moves from monsters to soldiers. Again, this is a child suffering from divorce, a terrible, terrible, angry divorce between his parents. And they're still pretty anonymous soldiers, but at least they're kind of evenly divided, you know, not monsters versus soldiers. Next one, please. I'm going to go, these, This was a person I worked with some time back who was an artist. And her sand play series is very, very beautiful, very balanced, very aesthetic. What I learned from her work with me was that the difference between somebody who really goes deeply unconscious and somebody who kind of stays on the surface. And even though these are very beautiful, she really doesn't go very deeply. And we'll see that from the last two series, which are much shorter. But hon, just go through these, okay? This she called a self-portrait. She used the hand about 15 times, 10, 15. I'd have to count how many, but okay. Again, here's the handprints. And here she's got the rose, the red rose. Next one, please. This was a hand, she said, the hand of a competent artist. And this is the palm underneath here. And then different symbols coming out of each finger. And look, she's got the snake, the Sabbatian snake, the fertility snake there. Okay, next one, please. At this point, you could see a problem. You know, one hand's so clear, and this hand has probably all the many figures from my collection. And at this point, what was becoming very clear was that she had a real problem with smoking marijuana, and the marijuana kept her from this. And she was able to resolve that in her work. But this was like such a clear thing. She said when she got high, felt like this. Next, please. No, there's more of these. Everything she was avoiding. Next. Then she created a face, and we'll see this with the other two cases too, that there was this wonderful face that came, something new. Next. And again, this beautiful spiral and hands. Next. And again, here the hands are three-dimensional, releasing these birds that are flying off into the sky. Next. That's a close-up. Next one. Another face. Next. And this is the end of the series where she's... there is a circular centering form with the boat, the canoe entering into that place. Okay, next time. These next three images are of a man who was suffering from cancer. And he had a very powerful healing dream. And notice, like here, all the handprints that just came from his working of the sand. And just think of it, like, in a way, how different that is from the images we've just seen. And this is him in between two earth goddesses who were healing him. Okay, next. And then look, he makes a face. That's the next time. And on the sides of the face are hand fingerprints again. And it was like this was some new aspect of himself that came forward. Next. After that, interestingly, feminine figures were introduced into his work. And we have here an earth goddess and a black Madonna. And I thought there was a Sphinx. I thought there was a Venus of Willendorf, but... and you can see the handprints again, very active in the sand. Next. And close-ups of the fingerprints. Next. And look at this one. And there it is again with the eye or the circle in the center. All right. Okay, and the next one. This was a mature woman who did a very long sand play process. And when she made this, she said, it feels like it's 60,000 years old. And I just start with that one because it's a very, such a powerful image. Next. The next time I saw her, She ran, at the last 5 minutes of our time together, she ran into the Sanplay room and created the circle and the square. And she said she was interested in the navel of the earth, which is here. And then she put her handprints down. I have a quote from Jung about the squaring of the circle, and I'm not going to read it because I want you to be able to play. So next one, please. Then the next time she came in, look what she's done. She's done the tree of life in the center. And the last thing she did in this tray was putting handprints on either side. So here, for me, this was a true example of a very deep centering and constellating of inner energies coming forward in her work. Next. Okay, and this is without the stuff in there. Let's see this again. And next. This was what happened after those handprint trays. She said, this is the position of a vulnerable woman, of a woman giving birth. And so it was like from her inner self, she was really feeling the birthing of something new inside her. Okay. 2 years later, she ran into the Sanplay room. And, I wasn't seeing her very frequently. And she just, at the end of the hour, she said, I have to put my hands in the sand. And, okay, next one. And the next time she came in, she creates this beautiful image. And this is a form called a mandorla. And in the center of the mandorla is the circle. A mandorla is the center of two circles that have come together. Now the next slide. Here, this is the ponds at the Chalice Well in Glastonbury, England. And the well, the waters from the well come down into these two ponds, which are circles. And maybe you can see the line. And in the center is created the mandorla, which is this almond shape. The next one. And here you can see it a little bit better again. And the next. So here, and wait till you hear this. You know what she said when she finished this? She said, this feels like it's come from the sea. And so here we have this new land coming again. So I'd like to leave and finish my talk with this image, which to me feels so much like this sacred time of now, of Christmas. Of this donkey and the greenery and animals and this beautiful circle and the mandorla shape. There's something new that's coming from the composting that we're doing now. So thank you very much. And let's pray.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.